Did you know that suicide is the leading cause of death for teens and young adults? According to the CDC, suicidal ideation and attempts among teens are nearly twice as high as they were pre-pandemic. We'll discuss this and other interesting facts about mental health with author and advocate Mark Hennick on this episode of The Curious Professor. Everyone, I'm Dr. B. Welcome to the Curious Professor podcast, where I take listeners on a journey of discovery to explore the people, places, artifacts, and natural wonders that spark my curiosity. On this episode of the Curious Professor podcast, we'll discuss depression, resilience, recovery, and hope with speaker and mental health advocate Mark Hennick. But first, a trivia question. How many people die by suicide each year in the USA? I'll have the answer for you at the end of this episode. I'm thrilled to have Mark Hennick on the show today. Mark's TED Talk, Why We Choose Suicide, is among the most watched in the world with over 6 million views. Mark has appeared in more than 100 television segments and countless more radio, print, and online features about mental health. His work has been featured in media across Canada, the UK, and the United States. Mark previously served as the youngest board director for the Mental Health Commission of Canada and the youngest president of a provincial Canadian Mental Health Association division. Mark brings a diverse and unique perspective of someone who has been a patient, a professional, and a policy influencer in the mental health system. When I learned about Mark's passion to break the stigma that prevents people from speaking openly about their mental health, my curiosity was immediately piqued and I wanted to learn more. I hope this interview with Mark will spark your curiosity too. Welcome to the show, Mark. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
What is the most important thing that I should know about you?
That I have, for my entire life, been living. And I think that that is something that a lot of people take for granted. But it's something that I've learned to be incredibly grateful for.
What makes your book So-Called Normal so special?
After I did my TED Talk in 2013, people came to me and said, you know, that's great that you were able to recover from suicidality, from severe and persistent mental illness over the course of several years, but you were lucky, or you're special, or you're different, or there's something about you that made it more possible for you to recover than not. And than me is what people often say. And what I wanted to do with my book, and what I think sets it out as something different, was to show that I wasn't special, that I was very normal, or so-called normal, in many ways, and that the struggles that I went through are the same struggles very often that too many people go through. So that's what I hope is special about my book, is that it shows that mental illness isn't something that happens to just a select, unfortunate segment of society, that it in fact can happen to anybody.
And what did you find most challenging about writing it?
You know, the challenge initially, I think, because we went through a lot of drafts, the challenge initially was fear of going really deep into my own story. And I had done the TED Talk by this point already, so I thought I had a pretty good grasp of my story. I'd been speaking for a couple of years anyway, but there was this big gaping hole in there that initially, when I did the TED Talk, I didn't know who the stranger in the light brown jacket was who saved my life. So that was the first big gap that I had identified. After I, in fact, did find that man who saved my life, who pulled me off the edge of a bridge one night, the story that I tell in the talk, I realized that there were a bunch of points in my story that kept bubbling up into my present. It was like I was just always wearing my past, just an inch below the surface. And I didn't know how to not live that way, to not be carrying that. So that, I think, was the challenge in writing the book, was to dig that stuff out from underneath my skin, to deal with it, and to put it back in a more coherent way. And I think that was also the work that I'm most grateful for with the book as well. It was the hardest to dig that stuff up again, but it was so necessary to do it.
And do you consider this a transformational book? And what I mean by that is, in the process of writing it, I'm sure you were thinking about how you could help others, but while you were writing it, you also transformed yourself.
You know, the funny thing was, you know, all of my work is about trying to help others, but writing the book really wasn't. I wrote the book for myself. And, I took the process very seriously. I actually was working in a senior management role for a national charity back in 2017 when I got the book deal. And for months, I tried to write it off the side of my desk, just as, you know, this is a book that I can write to help other people. And it became abundantly clear to me several months in that this wasn't something that I could write off the side of my desk, that I needed to dedicate my whole self to it. So I left that job. I went away to a Trappist monastery in the woods, and I wrote, it can be a bit intense. I wrote this, the first draft of this book, which my editor, my publisher wanted 90,000 words to begin with. That's about standard for a memoir. I ended up submitting, I think, on that first draft, 145,000 words or something. So it was way too long because I was just mining all this material. And then over the course of the next, what ended up being, I think, 2.5 years, we went through more than a dozen different drafts to really figure that story out. So, you know, so it was for me. And time again in my story have seen that when I share myself most authentically, most personally, that's actually what ends up helping people the most. It's not when I come out and say, hey, here's a catchy acronym for something you can do to remember how to take care of yourself. It's no, I'm having a really hard time right now, and I feel like an imposter, and I don't know what I'm doing half the time. And that's the stuff that clicks with people.
So do you feel like there's another book inside you?
I'm working on it now. It's a very different book. What started out as, hey, I have this idea. I said to my literary agent, I've got this idea for a book. And he said, great, work on an outline for it. Because in the writing process, you query, see if there's interest, and then you do an outline, you write some sample chapters. I started doing the outline and I ended up just 30,000 words just poured out of me. So I started writing the book and I didn't even mean to. So I think that's going to be, that's the one that I really want to write. Not that I didn't want to write my memoir. I needed to write my memoir. This is the book that now that I'm working on that I want to write.
So it's more of a passion project.
I think it is. And it's more, I'm trying to unpack how people learn depression. And every time I say that, I find that there's a variety of responses I get from people. You know, you don't learn depression. It's an illness, right? You get sick with depression. But if you actually look at the neurobiological basis of learning and memory, you have to neurologically learn depression. So I want to explore, how do we learn depression neurologically, psychologically, but then socially as well, because so much of my own personal experience was social conditioning. I didn't want to open up about my struggles because I received implicit messaging all around me all the time that it wasn't safe to open up about that. So I'm fascinated by how those three domains interact. And I've been getting bored with the current contents of my mind. So I've been trying to add more so that way I can have some more fun.
Is it implied then, if you believe that depression is learned, then people can unlearn it?
This is, I think, the most exciting part for me, that that's really where I started. How do you unlearn depression? What is recovery? And I think there's a lot of different routes to that, but I came back to what really triggered it for me was that looking at conditioning research, classical conditioning research, operant conditioning research over the last many years, I don't want to get too technical or too into the weeds on this, but it turns out that you can't, literally speaking, unlearn a response. You can't erase something that has already been imprinted in you. That really resonated with me because I can't unthink my past thoughts of suicide. I can't just suddenly forget that I, for a good chunk of my teenage years, wanted to die. So then what can I do if I can't erase that? And we've been trying to do that in clinical circles for a long time, whether it's lesioning or surgery or electrocution or all kinds of ways to try to erase those pieces. So then what can you do instead? And it turns out if you can find or build, I should say, more efficient pathways that do the same things, but in a more productive way, in a healthier way, that then those pathways can take over from the unhelpful pathways. And that, so then therefore we're layering learning. We can relearn healthier ways of being, neurologically speaking, rather than just always focusing on, I wish I didn't have this. Well, you do. So there's this piece of acceptance that is required in order to change. And I love that idea.
You're a mental health advocate and you feel it is important to talk openly about suicide. Tell us why you think this is so important.
Well, first of all, we know that talking about suicide doesn't give people the idea to go out and do it. This has been researched many times. And one of the most effective protective factors against suicide is talking openly. So if for no other reason, that it helps to reduce reduce suicide if we can reduce the stigma around it and the silence around it. Now, there are helpful ways and unhelpful ways of talking about suicide. We know that, you know, you can compare the media coverage of Kurt Cobain's death back in the 90s when he died by suicide compared to Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade later on. Robin Williams is a less sterling example because there were a lot of mistakes made in the coverage of his suicide. But what I think that really shows, though, why I mentioned those notable people, everybody's notable, but why I mentioned those celebrities is because it really provides a contrast of how far we've grown in this conversation about suicide. We need to be able to talk about it realistically, but we also need to inspire hope. Suicide is not inevitable. 100% of suicides, I would argue, somewhat controversially, I think, 100% of suicides are preventable. The problem is that we're failing to prevent them because we're failing people as a society. So I think that we need to have these conversations because that's what really brings these issues out into the open. And that's what gets people access to the types of help that we know can help them with the underlying issues that lead to suicide.
You also speak of a lack of options or choices, a loss of hope. You talk about collapse perception and its relationship to suicide. Tell us more about these ideas.
So I think for me, the toxic combination is that of hopelessness and helplessness. When you feel like nothing will ever get better, hopelessness. And that there's, and even worse, that there's nothing you can do to make it better or to assist it in getting better. That's the helplessness piece. When those two things cross, then you find yourself stuck. And I use the term cognitive perceptual collapse in the TED Talk, which really caught on for people, it seems, ever since then. And really what's at the core of that is cognitive rigidity, that when you're feeling threatened, when you're feeling like you are hopeless and helpless, like you have no other options, evolutionarily speaking, your mind collapses in to focus on the things that you can control, to be hyper aware of the things that keep you alive. Because even, ironically, even when you're suicidal, it's your brain's default to keep itself alive. That's its only, your whole body is just a life support system for your brain. That's what it's supposed to do. So it thinks it's helping to try to do things that are often maladaptive, collapsing your perception in on this one thing, in my case, suicide, that I thought that I had control of or my own life. So I think for me, that idea really, and the point of the TED Talk was to examine how that impacts how we see the world and specifically our free will, our ability to choose. Do people choose to end their life? I actually don't think that I think they decide to end their lives, but they don't choose because it's not a free choice. If your choice is, this is my only choice, then that's not a choice. And I think that's where that cognitive collapse necessarily leads you, is to that place where it blocks everything else out and it feels like that's your only option. So that's the one that you act on.
I'm a survivor of suicide. My father died by suicide when he was 45. What would you say to people like me whose lives were forever changed by the suicide of a loved one?
Yeah, you know, I hear this all the time, whether it's kids of parents who have died by suicide. And we know that middle-aged men are the highest risk group for completed suicide, followed by teenage boys in particular. You know, we can't prevent suicides, of course, that have already happened. And that seems like a bit of a truism, but I think that helps us to recognize that that other person was struggling with something that by design, the illness didn't want to be found out. It wanted to hide itself from you, from his other loved ones. So I think we need to be able to recognize those two facts, that we have to accept what has already happened, of course, for our own healing, but also to relieve ourselves of the guilt that is often associated with questions like, why didn't I see it coming? That's by far the most common question that I hear. And I think the reason for that is because love sometimes gets in the way. When you're too close to somebody, your mind out of necessity blocks out the possibility that this might ever happen. And that's very normal. So that's why I think it really speaks to the need for frontline healthcare providers to have training in recognizing the signs and asking the right questions, for, in a broad-based way, everybody to have some sort of gatekeeper training in terms of having effective, authentic conversations with people. And in particular, recognizing if there might be other risk factors, even if the person isn't expressing any kind of symptoms of a mental illness or signs that they might be suicidal, having these kinds of conversations in a cultural, having a society wherein it's okay for men in particular to talk about their feelings, then that on its own helps us to recognize when people might be suicidal and to get them the help that they need. So for family members, you know, I think that it can be helpful to share your story as well, helpful. It's often helpful to share your story because there are so many other people who have gone through this too. And it can feel, grief can feel incredibly isolating and lonely. But if there's anything that I've learned from sharing my own experience is that when you feel most alone, it turns out there's a whole lot of people out there who are feeling alone too. So you can all be alone together. And I think that's the way out of the darkness.
Who's been your greatest influence on you and your work?
Oh my, that's a great question. I've had a lot of influences, both academic. I mean, I identify as an intellectual, as an introvert, as a thinker, a reader. So there's a lot of people that, of course, I've never met or are long dead that have influenced me. And there's a small handful of people who are still alive and actually impacted me in practical ways. One of my most, or probably the most powerful influence that I had in the work that I do today was the stranger who saved me on the bridge that night. And I didn't realize that for a very long time, but he created in me this flashbulb memory, this imperative to be like the stranger in the light brown jacket who saved my life, to reach out to others, to create brave space for people and to help people. So he was one of the most powerful influences for me, for sure. His name is Mike, by the way. I much later found him. But then intellectually, when I went away to college, for whatever reason, I think through the intervention of a really wonderful professor that I had, fell into Dante's works, the Divine Comedy, particularly the Inferno. I mentioned this briefly in the book, I think, as well. I don't remember if it made the final cut or not. It might have been too esoteric, but reading Dante's Divine Comedy and specifically the Inferno provided for me a map to my own mind, a map through my own depression. For those who aren't familiar with it, the Inferno starts with these images at the opening of hell. It's an epic quest of Dante's journey through hell, purgatory, and paradise. And it opens with him entering into hell from a place where he just feels completely lost. He just wakes up in the middle of the woods. He suddenly realizes he's lost and he doesn't know how he got there. And then as he progresses through hell, the opening image, the opening layers of hell are windy and chaotic and unintentional and, you know, blustery, I guess is the word. But then as he progresses deeper, at the very core of hell, the souls are encased in ice. They're completely immobilized and can't move. So the entire progression through hell for Dante is this perceptual collapse. It's this becoming rigid as you go down. And that's where that idea came from, actually, that at the worst part of hell, you're completely immobilized. And that for me was how depression felt, like I was frozen.
Fascinating. So what's ahead? What are you most excited about right now?
A number of things. I'm always excited about something. I'm an easily excitable person, even though I'm fairly, even most of the time. I think people who know me that I'm quite emotional and effervescent. But anyway, I think I'm excited certainly about this new book that I'm working on. That's going to be a long-term project, but I'm excited about that. I'm also really excited about getting back, ideally at some point, to speaking live in person. My first live event since the pandemic, it's actually my second, but the other one was a while ago and it was brief, but is coming up in a month. I'm supposed to fly down to Texas for that. And I'm hoping that it continues because I haven't been on a big stage in front of a lot of people in a long time. And that's something that I really enjoy. I think it's something that really helps me. It helps me to help others, but it helps me personally to be able to share in that way. So I'm really looking forward to getting back on live stages and interacting with more people again.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about you or your work?
Well, you know, I think my approach to mental health is decidedly biopsychosocial. And what I mean by that is that there's a lot of messaging now, it seems. There's been a lot of attention on mental health, and that's a good thing. But it seems like the pendulum has swung really hard toward a biological model of mental illness. And that's an important part of mental health. Don't get me wrong. We have decades of research to show that there are biological and neurological correlates of mental illness. But the brain is necessary, but not sufficient for mental health. I think it's not enough to say, go take your pills or talk. It's important to talk to your doctor. It's important to do all those things. But I never recovered in hospital. And even working as a clinician, I never met anybody who recovered in hospital. We recover in the real world. So that's why I think it's important that people remember that, yes, your brain is important for mental health, but so is your diet. So is your exercise. So is having a fair living wage. So is having relationships that nourish you. So does having hobbies and interests that that cultivate your passion. All of this stuff, it isn't just fluff. It's actually really important for your mental health. So I talk about that a lot, and I want people to know that there is no right way to recovery, that there are many routes to recovery. And I'm of the view that if one thing isn't working for you, there's lots of other options to try. So please try all of the options and persist until you get to a place in your life that is where you want to be. You deserve that. So pursue it doggedly.
And just a quick question. What is your feeling about the transpersonal element? You had mentioned the staying in a Buddhist monastery at one point. Is that part of your perspective? Do you have any kind of spiritual component or transpersonal component to what you're doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have an active, primarily Buddhist mindfulness practice now, but I actually stayed in a Trappist monastery, which is an order of Cistercian of Catholic monks. And what I got from that actually was an incredible, the idea of the Trappists, like many other cloistered orders, is to work and pray. You do the work and then you go and talk to God or whoever your vision of God is. This isn't just for Catholics. And then you go back to work again. Those are the only two things you have to concern yourself with. And why that was so important for me was that having that schedule, having that structure to my day just unleashed my creativity. And I think I learned so much about structuring my own day outside of the monastery as well, to be able to allow for that to happen. So, you know, I think that between that experience, a very structured experience, as well as my meditative practices now in my day-to-day life, I think it's incredibly important to be able to face your inner self and everything that's in there. And sometimes it's not always easy. It's work sometimes. It's scary and hard sometimes. But you have to develop that relationship with that self inside you so you can develop that firm, solid inner core. And then it matters a lot less what happens outside of you. Everything else is just other people trying to find their own way too. So I think that's an important part of my ongoing well-being, is to make sure that I'm cultivating my relationship with myself in a spirit of kindness.
And where can listeners find out more about you?
I'm not hard to find. I'm on most social media platforms at Mark Hennick. That's at MarkHennick. My book, So-Called Normal, A Memoir of Family Depression and Resilience, is available on Amazon across Canada at Indigo, in the US at Barnes & Noble and major bookstores worldwide. And my website is markhennick.com, which I occasionally update with some of the new projects that I'm working on.
It was wonderful to have you on the show, Mark. Thank you so much for taking time to be a guest on the Curious Professor podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And now for the answer to this episode's trivia question. How many people die by suicide each year in the USA? According to the CDC, over 48,000 Americans die by suicide each year. That's one death by suicide every 11 minutes in the USA. We'll end the show with something punny. Why did the pediatrician get angry so often? Because he had little patience. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Curious Professor Podcast. If there's a person, place, artifact, or natural wonder that has sparked your curiosity and you'd like for me to feature it on the show, please let me know. My website is thecuriousprofessorpodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe to The Curious Professor Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to become part of my community of curiosity seekers, be sure to visit my website, thecuriousprofessorpodcast.com, and join Dr. B's Hive. Until next time, always be learning and be curious with Dr. B.